This episode of Breaking Brave is brought to you by Crank Coffee, the newest member of the Neal Brothers family. Crank Coffee is a new Canadian whole bean coffee brand that is certified organic and fair trade, founded by the Neal Brothers, Peter and Chris. This brand was influenced by cycling, coffee lovers, and experts. Check it out at the Neal Brothers online shop and use our coupon code BRAVE for 20% off your first Crank Coffee purchase. Enjoy. And I wanted to mention that if you would like to connect with me directly, you can always do so at marilynbarefoot.com or breakingbrave.show. I see and answer every single contact personally, and I would truly love to hear from you. Welcome to Breaking Brave. I'm your host, Marilyn Barefoot. And I'm thrilled to welcome back Dr. Ben Bravery. Dr. Ben is a man on a mission. He's a psychiatrist and a cancer survivor who wants to improve the healthcare system, and he has a plan on how to do it. We last spoke to Ben on March the 1st of 2023. The reason he's back is because his incredibly powerful and inspiring memoir, The Patient Doctor, is now available in North America. It has received rave reviews, and Ben is back to tell us why. Please welcome the incredibly brave Dr. Ben Bravery. Dr. Ben Bravery is a man on a mission. You are a psychiatrist and a cancer survivor who is battling to change the healthcare system. Welcome back, Dr. Ben.
Thank you, Marilyn. Please do call me Ben.
Okay. I wanted to talk to you specifically about your fabulous and incredible book, The Patient Doctor, which is now available in North America, I understand.
That's correct. It's in Canada via Indigo.
Yeah.
And then in the US via a whole range of suppliers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc.
Good for you.
Yeah.
How is the North American populace receiving this beautiful book? Are you getting great feedback? Is it hitting nicely? What's the general feeling?
So I think, let's be honest about this. Here's the interesting thing, Marilyn. So when I first wrote the book, the publisher was realistic about what this could and couldn't be internationally for two reasons. One is I've got an experience which is particular to Australian healthcare, and each healthcare system is idiosyncratic and subject to a whole range of pressures. You know, the most extreme version of that is the American healthcare system, which is a completely different ballgame, and then mine, which is a hybrid universal private healthcare system to more, strictly universal publicly funded healthcare. So there's that. The second thing is, It's like each area has a me, right? So there's someone locally who has, for whatever reason, arrived at a set of ideas about healthcare and is trying to change it. And they have a local following. They have local knowledge. Whereas, this wasn't the kind of book like, anything written by Atul Gawande, you might know, is a famous surgeon who's written a bunch of widespread New York Times bestseller books about healthcare. The stuff I'm addressing, while mostly universal and about compassion and empathy and communication in healthcare, I don't have that kind of following, I guess, right? So that's a long way of saying my book is a slow burn. So what that means is that it's out there and it's available and it's in print, which is awesome. And it takes key individuals to pick it up in local areas and then want to talk about it like you have in order for it to get traction in more local markets. We might talk later what's happened in my part of the world and its spread to other countries, but the North American market is there for the picking. And I've got ambitions, but it's going to be slow.
Okay, excellent. I've got reviews up on my wall that say things like, Interesting book to read heading into my internship. Some good concepts to think about. How does the system disempower patients? How can junior doctors advocate for their patients? And how does med school squash your empathy? You've got other followers who talk about this should be required reading for anybody going into med school. And I would agree with it, no matter what the system is, the core values of what you're embracing in the book, 100% necessary in this whole world.
Yeah, and I'm biased because I wrote it, but I totally agree with you as well. I think it does have themes, and that the whole, you know, one of my agendas when writing it was not to be a super specific memoir that was my experience and stopped there. I tried at key points in my own journey of learning through medical school to scale up the idea, right? So I'd have an encounter, I'd have an idea about that encounter, and then I would go and look for examples that other people had experienced. And I went to the scientific literature and found lots of examples, very good studies done all around the world, explaining the same kinds of things I'd observed throughout med school. You're right, there are reviews from around the world. There's a little pocket of people in Europe, France in particular, that have taken to the book. There's a growing group of people in the UK, with all its problems in healthcare. There's hundreds of Goodreads reviews, which obviously are from different jurisdictions. And so it consistently gets rated highly. And I think a lot of healthcare providers, nurses, psychologists, physiotherapists, and doctors have really resonated with the ideas. And I think it's really nice to see them taking then it back to their own places of work and health systems to see, you know, hey, there's this guy who did this thing. And he's got these ideas, and then they're not new ideas. I should really stress that, Marilyn. Like, the stuff I'm saying is not rocket science. I haven't invented anything. I'm just coming at it with this really weird skill set, which is like, I studied animals and then I got sick and then I became a doctor and I've put it all together. And it's that is new here. I'm very aware of that, but I'm just one voice and I'm part of a movement, right? And I think I've seen that in the reviews that have trickled in. And the speaking invitations that have trickled in, there's definitely a movement for change. And that's really exciting to be a part of.
I have been, since I originally met you when we did our first interview and the episode that dropped on March the 1st. So anybody listening to this who wants to go back and get the context, then that episode is available to listen to first. You've been on a speaking binge, Ben. Like, yes. I've seen you at conferences and on panels. And then there was this Julie McCrossan AM conversation with you and other people. We'll just talk about Australia because that's, I think, where most of the traction has been that I've been observing from Canada. But good for you. How's that feeling for you? Not only as a psychiatrist, but now as a speaker and a panelist.
Yeah, so I think the thing to say about that is just to clarify that where I'm at in my training, I can't yet call myself a psychiatrist, which sucks. I'm training, and so we tend to reserve that word for people that are right down the end of the training pipeline. So I'm what you call a resident in your language, a registrar in mine, or a trainee anywhere else in the world. Yeah, I've got a couple of years left. How does it feel? It's good. I was a bit nervous writing the book, because you're never quite sure, going back to what we were talking about, how generalizable content is and with how people are going to interact with it. People take the time to write to me who have read the book, and they're so funny because they, when I reply, they're surprised, because I guess they assume like I've written a book and it's a big publisher and that I have a whole like PR machine, but I don't. It's just me. And so the emails come to me and then I write back to them, and they're like, oh, wow, I never thought you would ever write back to me. It's like, well, no, you took the time to share how this book has changed you, or how you're going to use this book as a tool in the future. And I think those experiences keep me going as much as the talks. I had a woman write to me a couple of weeks ago on LinkedIn, which has been a really surprising avenue for engagement. I didn't see that coming. And I've thrown a lot of energy into that. And she'd had a friend diagnosed with a tumor, and she gave her my book as a part of her diagnosis. And she ended up in hospital, and she was reading it in hospital, and she was pointing out sections to the doctors during ward rounds. And she, you know, they met and discussed it at key points in her care. And, you know, it's something that she gives to people when they are going to get pulled into the healthcare system. I thought that was such a nice way to let me know that it is making an impact. The talks are really good. I didn't expect to see the kinds of audiences reach out like they have. It's, you know, it's everything from insurance companies. So we have like a medico-legal insurer here in Australia. Now, it's a very different thing to North America because our doctors don't get sued as much. But it was like the medico-legal, we have them, and a medico-legal insurer decided that this was important enough that they wanted all their brand new intern members to get the book. So they bought a copy for each new intern that joined last year, and they sent it to them as a part of their like welcome to medicine. Then, you know, at the other end, it's like big pharma are very interested in how to reconnect with the people that they're developing medications for. You know, pharma have had a very interesting relationship with patients. Like they need them to be sick, obviously, to develop drugs to make money, and they need them in the design of those drugs. But, you know, some of the big ones have felt a growing disconnect, you know, much like I wrote about and we talked about last time. Medical schools have been interested in having me along. Different colleges like anaesthetist, social work, psychology have had me along. It's been marvelous. But Marilyn, I might need some coaching about it all because I feel like a giant imposter.
Oh, no. I've watched and I've listened and you're excellent. And the thing that I keep seeing coming through in the reviews, because obviously I'm not sitting in any sort of a theater in Australia watching you on a panel or watching you speak, but here's one that I think just is the reason that this is taking off for you. Ben Bravery, I just devoured your book. It should be required reading for anyone working in healthcare. A lot of people will read your book and think, I want to be mates with that guy because your authenticity shines through. And as a mom of young boys, I really appreciate how you can have role-modeled strength through your vulnerability. So I think there's nothing worse than a polished speaker who just kind of polishes it up, a canned speech, and stands up and gives it. You'll never be that. You're real and you're who you are and you lay it out there. And that's, I think that's why people fall in love with you and your work and the book and everything you stand for. So good for you. Enjoy it and know that you're making a difference. But on that note, it's been out now in Australia for what, a couple years?
It's been a year and 5 months.
You're in 5 months.
Yeah.
So in that time, have you seen, heard of, experienced change, or how do you rate the impact that it's having?
Yeah, I think that's a big question. It's a really hard, you know, in your professional background, you know, measuring impact is really often difficult. And it can be difficult when we talk about these really big concepts that aren't really that well defined themselves in terms of research and metrics. I think it has, but I'm very realistic that it's a big goal. And I think there's a lot of people working on different programs around the place, all chipping away at this. You know, the thing I really didn't appreciate was the value. This sounds weird because I've written a book about myself, but I didn't fully appreciate the power of a story, which is strange because I've written a story. But I just thought I was another person with cancer, and there are lots of the beautiful stories out there about people that have overcome tragedy. But there's something about, I think, the vulnerability. I think the fact that I do go into the taboo, both in terms of my cancer and, you know, it's bowel cancer. It's not pretty. It does involve bums and poo. I think there's that side of me, and males don't generally, you know, I'm talking very generally, but we tend not to be strong health advocates. You know, we tend to rely on people around us to have those stories and conversations for us. So there's that. And then there's the taboo of medicine, you know, like it's like, I'm a tall male doctor calling out the crap that is in med school. And in a way, you know, I'm like lifting the veil a bit about what goes on. And I'm being very transparent as much as possible about letting people into a world that is both cancer and medical education and the patient doctor relationship. And I think people are hungry for that. I think we've relied too much on the smoke and mirrors of medicine, the theater, I call it, to reinforce power and to reinforce information differences. And I'm letting people into that world, and I'm doing it in a way that certainly the feedback I'm getting is I'm doing it in a way that is new to them.
Yeah.
And that they're, whatever reason, whether it's a sign of the times or it's a sign of the moment they're connecting with. I did a talk recently for a pharmaceutical company. They intimidate me, right? Because they're like, it's pharma. And I went into the talk.
The big, huge pharma business. I understand why you'd be intimidated.
And they're technical and they're deeply scientific and they're very sophisticated. I went and did a talk and I was addressing their national meeting. So they pulled all their staff from Australia and New Zealand together. And I just went through the parts of my story that I thought would resonate with them as people that basically make and sell drugs. And then I, you know, grounded it in my experience, you know, my experience in China and what I was studying and how I ended up, the evolution of my sickness. And then started to call a bunch of stuff out about medicine. And, you know, these are seasoned executives. And, you know, someone wrote to me afterwards and they're like, that's the best keynote I've seen in 25 years. And I feel really silly telling you that and sharing it on the podcast, but like I'm finally seeing that it's almost like validation that there is a space for me here. Like I can contribute something. And then, you know, that takes us back to North America. There's just so much opportunity to influence these small conversations and these small programs in ways that are potentially really exciting.
And you should be proud of that, because if somebody says that that's the best keynote they've heard in 25 years, that means the way you're speaking, the way you're telling your story, the authenticity and the humility that you're using in the book and in your presentations, that's what humans are craving right now. I mean, you are the embodiment of what you're asking for in the book.
Mm.
Human, caring, making the experience pleasant and make the patient feel good.
You made a good point there. I think it's a product of the time, right? And I think we can't ever, you know, you and I talked about this last time, we can't ever talk about this stuff without talking about COVID. I just think it's been such a huge disruptor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are wanting to connect. You know, it's interesting. I was talking to my publisher, like the COVID trends in books were really interesting. Like people went away from nonfiction and they went to fiction. And I think they wanted story and fantasy and adventure and connection. I thought that was really interesting. I think you might be right. I think you might have hit the nail on the head that it's at a time when people are wanting that, you know, they're really wanting to connect.
Absolutely. Let's jump to your health, because I had that up as my first question. Are you okay? Have you got still a clean bill of health? Everything's good. I mean, I should have started with that. That was very unfeeling of me not to ask that first.
No, that's okay. Yeah, so things took a turn after we first met and recorded the first podcast. And it was a really, it's kind of the universe is funny. You know, I'm out promoting these ideas and I've got this book and I'm living this life, and then bang, this reminder that things are precarious. So I had a colonoscopy, which was about to be scaled back to every 5 years. I have them regularly, but then we were about to scale them back to every 5 years, and we'd stretched it to 3 years. And that was a part of this, the weaning. And between the one I had in June just passed and 3 years ago, my colon has, my large bowel has sprouted polyps. Now, for listeners, polyps are little out pockets of growth that can then become cancer. They don't all become cancer, but cancers nearly always start off as a polyp.
Yeah, okay.
And they take about, you know, the data tells us they take about 5 to 10 years to get from a polyp to a tumor. Now, what was worrying was that I'd grown over 20 of these things all of a sudden. So until now, my colon, apart from the original tumor, has been like every other colon.
Right.
And this colonoscopy happens and they find all these growths, and one of the growths is very large. And one of the growths, the large one, has started to undergo some changes which are starting to look like cancer. And it was just a reminder. They chopped it out, which is great. And it's very, very early, but it's a reminder that there's something going on inside me.
I get the hell of a reminder. Yeah, but did they do a biopsy on it and give you some results as to whether it was okay or it wasn't okay once they removed
it? They cut them all out. They cut 3 out of the 20. Okay. There's no need to take them all out because some of them are quite small. The biggest one, which is the one they were worried about, did have what they call precancer changes in it. So it had cells in it that were on their way to becoming a malignancy, and that's very concerning because I'd only had a scope 3 years ago and this polyp wasn't there, let alone it didn't have changes in it that started to resemble cancer. So I've had some discussions since then thinking like, what is going on with me? Because I got the bowel cancer diagnosis, but never any other explanation for why at 28 I got this tumor. And so I'm back again thinking about what might be the reason. And I've had genetic testing and I've revisited that because, you know, this whole time I'm worried about me, but I'm terrified for my son. You know, I don't know if I've passed this on. So there's been lots of those big questions. It was a very dark few days while I processed that. And the unfortunate thing was, it's a very good reminder for why I'm doing what I'm doing. The colonoscopy experience and follow-up was not great. And, you know, if people think because I've written a book and it's on bookshelves and I'm relatively well known here in Australia that I get special treatment, they can think again. It wasn't great. And I'm in discussion with my doctor about giving that feedback, but it's tricky. As all your listeners who have ever had healthcare have been a little dissatisfied know.
Yeah.
So it was kind of, Marilyn, it was kind of very grounding from a few different perspectives. And the next colonoscopy, now I need them every 6 months. So rather than...
I was going to say, they've probably brought that time frame in a lot, haven't they?
You bet they did. So the next one's in a month.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we're all praying for you that whatever that was has gone and the next one will be incredible. Mm. And have they given you any indication on the genetic testing or is everything here just a big question mark still?
This is the thing with... bowel cancer, they call it early onset bowel cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's largely tricky. There's lots of theories. So there's two things to say here. One is, and your listeners should please pay attention to this of all ages, it is increasing in younger people. We know that for a fact. So bowel cancer is going up in people under 50, right? And it's kind of stable in people over 50 because we've got great screening programs. You know, there's the little poo test. And then you can have a colonoscopy, of course. In younger people who aren't a part of those screening programs, the cancer's going up. They don't know why. It's well documented since the 1990s that in people under 50, the cancer's increasing. There's lots of theories. They involve fiber. They involve a lack of exercise. They involve processed meats, processed red meats in particular. They involve something called ultra processed foods. So foods that don't really resemble their core ingredients, you know, think about like an ultra processed protein ball or something like that. You know, it doesn't look like any of the things inside it.
Right.
And, you know, candy, for example, right? Like lollies and candy don't look like sugar at all.
Right.
They've had lots of things done to them. So there's something about that. So I don't have any family history. Most people who get it young don't, unless you've got one of the really two well-known genetic disorders that can cause early onset bowel cancer, but I tested negative for those. And then I tested negative for all the other things they think sometimes contribute to it genetically. And what's really interesting, Marilyn, is it's a state of the science and how hard this stuff is. In the 11 years between my initial colonoscopy and the one that just showed that, you know, colonic explosion, the genetic tests haven't really changed. So it's not like all of a sudden now I can send my sample off and they'll work it out.
Yeah.
Because they still don't know.
So what would you then recommend for younger people in Canada, at least? I don't know how it works in the States, but in Canada, the Ministry of Health can send you a little kit and you do your little poo test and then it gets sent back to a lab and then you get a letter that says you're good or you're not good.
Yeah.
Is that sort of the same in Australia or is that what people should be doing at like any age, 20 and above?
So that's a really good point. And in terms of ways that I'm involved in change, I've just been a part of the national committee that's redesigned our bowel cancer screening guidelines in Australia, and they reflect international best practice. So we have programs just like yours and lots of countries do, where at a certain age, you get a poo kit in the mail or you have to go pick it up, or a doctor hands it to you and they're like, okay, you're of age now. It's time to check for this. That's a screening test. And then, like you said, it's thumbs up, thumbs down. If it's thumbs down, you go off and have a colonoscopy so they can actually see. Yeah. Some programs just give you a colonoscopy straight away. They don't do the poo test. What we're saying for younger people, so there's a couple of things to say. One is we just reduce the age at which we think people should have access to a poo test and a colonoscopy. And we've dropped that to 45. So it's getting lower and lower. So that tells you that the data is changing.
Okay.
The second thing is what we've said to younger people, we've got a campaign here called Never Too Young. So bowel cancer was traditionally seen as like an obese older man's disease, which meant that a lot of women, a lot of younger people got missed. What we're saying is you're never too young. Pay attention to changes in bowel habits, so constipation, diarrhea, pain, bloating, and especially bleeding.
Yeah.
So any of those things, please go along to a doctor. And it might take a couple of visits. It might take you needing to keep a poo log or a food diary or something like that. But please advocate for yourself and say, look, I've got these changes. They're not normal for me. What do you think we should do? I'm worried I might have a bowel cancer. And then get some advice from a doctor about that.
Fantastic and excellent advice. Thank you. So what's next for you, Ben? What's next for you? Is there another book? Our country's coming at you saying
Marilyn,
we need to translate it.
Talk about pressure, please.
What's next, or what are you dreaming of, like as a sort of a horizon line?
Oh man, so it's kind of exciting. I think I'm pivoting. I'm in a critical change in my career where I need to now subspecialize. So I've decided on psychiatry, and I've done that because they tend to, although not perfectly, focus on the whole person still, take time. They don't jump to conclusions. It's all the things I care about. Then I stumbled across a part of psychiatry called consultation liaison, or CL psychiatry. And this is mental health in hospitals outside of the mental health units. So, for example, we get called in when, you know, let's say you come in for a knee replacement and you've got an anxiety disorder, or you've got schizophrenia or bipolar and you need to have, you know, a tumor removed from your breast or something. We'll get called in to provide advice. We also get called in when people don't cope with hospital, right? Because it sucks. Mm-hmm. And any brain in hospital can get overwhelmed and distressed. To me, this is, I found my place. Like I found where I can be in a hospital and come in at the point between a patient and their healthcare team. It's a challenging space to walk into, but I love walking into it. We'll often get referrals. You know, the patient is difficult or challenging. They're words I don't like to use to describe patients, because being sick is difficult and challenging. And you realize, you know, you talk to a person, you spend 30 minutes with them, you realize they don't have an anxiety disorder. They're just like understanding what's going on.
Yeah.
You know,
and they're confused and upset. Yeah.
And one team says one thing and one team says another thing, and they don't understand what the medications are for, and they don't know why they need this procedure. So you come in and you kind of map the system and you think about where do I need to intervene here? Is it a conversation with the doctors? Is it a little session with the nurses? Is it a sheet I put up on the wall that says, my name is Michael, I like to understand what's happening, have my name used in a sentence, have a written record of my medications, like you can basically problem solve. And you avoid things like depressive illnesses and exacerbations of anxiety. So I've found my place. That's where I'm going to spend the next 2 years specializing. In terms of book stuff, I just got back really nice, excitingly, from a week in Singapore.
Oh.
I was invited by an organization called Sing Health, who provides about half to a third, three quarters of that country's healthcare, from the Office of the Patient Experience. One of them had read my book, listened to it actually, to be correct, and said, we should get this guy over to come and talk to us, our doctors, our executives, our patient groups, our system designers, about healthcare and patient-centered care. So that was really nice. That's the first time I've been able to leave the country with it. So I popped over a couple of weeks ago. I did a week of talks, panels, facilitated discussions. I met with Ostomy Association. So if you've had a bag for any reason during bowel cancer treatment, usually I met with them. I met with collectives of patient groups, childhood cancer, HIV. I met with people that work in hospitals and design this stuff. I talked to teams that handle patient complaints and thinking about other reasons that patients might get upset or offended in the hospital system. I went on tour of their brand new cancer center. It was really exciting. It was a really nice place to share my ideas in another culture, which is kind of exciting, and see the differences in the doctor-patient relationship play out in different cultures. And then I had to come back to Australia and zip over to New Zealand, where I went and spoke at a conference in Wellington of social workers and psycho-oncologists who are thinking about this stuff at the same time at a system level. So it's nice. It's really good. And I hope to be able to do more of that now that the books, like North America was the last to come online. So now it's North America, Africa, Southeast Asia, Europe, and the UK. And obviously Asia Pacific out of Sydney. So now it's available in all these places. Hopefully, you know, people will pick it up. And it just takes one. It just takes one person to read it. And if that person happens to run a health department or run a patient engagement charity, you know, I will come and speak to anybody because I'm so keen to share.
And they love it. I mean, when you get feedback like, this is the best keynote I've heard in 25 years. So that's like the most perfect place, Ben, for you to say, how do people find you, connect with you, ask you to come to Hawaii to their next big pharma conference or something? I've always wanted to be hired by somebody in Hawaii. So let's ask for Hawaii. Yeah, exactly. Or follow you on all your socials. And then that's part A of the question. Part B is, where and how do they buy the book?
Thank you for the opportunity to share that. So there's my name's unique. It's Ben Bravery. And it's funny, just in Singapore, I got that question at least twice a day. Is it my real name? I think there's a misperception.
Or you're writing under a pseudonym or something, maybe.
Is that real? Or did you change it because of the book? Like, no, come on. I like things being authentic, right? So it's Ben Bravery. And so if you type that into any search engine, the thing that usually pops up is a website. It's just mine, and there's a form on there. You can just write to me, send me an automatic email. And then there's I'm on Twitter under Dr. Ben Bravery. I'm on LinkedIn under Ben Bravery, and I use Instagram under Dr. Ben Bravery, and they're all open, and people can message me and follow, and I'll follow back on those platforms. The book is now – so there's printed copies all over the place, but it's probably easier just to jump online or go to your local bookstore. And online, you can get it anywhere. All the Amazons have it, for example, mm-hmm. but then all the independent online platforms also have it in any jurisdiction. And you just can type in the patient doctor, Ben Bravery. And that last check before coming on today, it was, you know, still able to be dispatched relatively quickly in most places.
Excellent. And I would encourage everybody in the whole world to read it because it is – it's a beautiful story, but it also gives us hope for what the future can be. So Ben, has your definition of bravery, other than your last name, changed for you, or the way you're seeing the world given the changes that have happened for you?
I think it's a work in progress. I think I was a bit more confident about this in March. Yeah, which you're picking up my apprehension. The only thing I would add is, and this might have been a part of what I mentioned in March, but just like, yes, you're going to have an emotional response to something and it's going to suck. But then there's a point where I tend to go, okay, so what can I do? Like, what can I learn? And then I ask a second question, is who needs to know about that? So I kind of, the bravery to me is like leaning in to that change, right? And thinking about, yeah, I've had it and it's great. And it's not getting on your soapbox. It's not being evangelical about it, or, you know, releasing TED Talks. It's just about thinking about, I've had this thing. Other people probably have. And their voice, you know, they might not be ready to voice like I am. And so it's about leaning into that space. And as you know, and you would know from your professional background, it can be uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
That can be an uncomfortable space. But for me, that's added a new dimension to the bravery.
And also the people that appreciate your sharing, that you don't know how many lives you've changed or people you've touched through the sharing of your story and answering questions or answering emails. I think that's something that you may never know, but it is brave to lean into that uncomfortable space, but do so knowing that you're touching so many people in a positive way.
Thank you so much. That's lovely.
You're very welcome. Is there anything that you wanted to say that I didn't ask you about during our catch-up chat?
How are you? You didn't tell me about you.
I'm fine. I had my daughter get married on September the 16th to an Australian man. Our house was hot and cold running Australians for about a month. And I've probably never laughed or had so much fun.
So anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt, but can we expect you down under then at some point?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Fantastic.
I have invitations all over the place.
Excellent.
So we're very excited about the opportunity to take that trip. And I will definitely be coming to see you speak somewhere when I'm in Australia.
That's awesome. At least we can catch up for coffee.
Exactly. Yeah. Would love that. And thank you so much. Thank you for what you're doing in this world. And we encourage everybody to pick up a copy of The Patient Doctor because it is a fabulous read. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening. For updates between episodes, I'd encourage you to join my mailing list, which you can do at either marilynbarefoot.com or breakingbrave.show. At most once a month, at least once a quarter, you'll receive an update on the latest resources, topics, and information I've found either super helpful or amazingly impactful. That's it for now. See you next time.